last time I was here. My name is Chris Seaman. I worked for Iron Crown Enterprises on the MERP series from about 1992 onwards, first as an author and then later as the editor for the series. And this was about at the same time that I was publishing Other Hands, the magazine, which the new publication is sort of the revived successor. And I did a little work for Decipher as well, and they're a very short book line. And since then, I've been trying to figure out what to do with myself, how best to keep the Middle-earth gaming scene going. And most of what I have to do is just take a plane flight whenever Hawk has MerkCon. But I have been attempting to explore the realm of online gaming. I know that there's been some actual work in this area of having a massive multi-user domains and things like that. I can't actually speak to that because I don't do that. I do my old-fashioned text messaging type stuff through email, which I find is far superior to all the other methods, other than live role playing, which is what we're doing here today. And what I wanted to talk about, I guess, was just a bit of my experiences working in online medium for Middle-earth. One of the benefits that I find that comes out of that as someone who designs the storylines is that everything moves at a pace which is slow enough that you can improvise without making it look like you're improvising. So it actually gives a lot more scope to players to actually shape the storyline as it progresses. Another thing that I've used very successfully in my current game is that I use multiple storylines in different parts of Middle-earth that are moving concurrently. And so, for example, the campaign that I've been working on, the Northern Waste, takes place obviously north of Eriador, and I do it on a timetable of characters trying to accomplish something there before something awful happens back home. But rather than just leave that awful thing as a kind of arbitrary event that could happen at any time I choose, instead I have a separate campaign line running on in Eriador with other players, and their actions actually determine the timeline. And so you can do that, and by putting it in the hands of the players, you make it far less arbitrary and, I guess, getting wants this. He has not yet entered into the game, but we're trying to train him here. This is one thing I've been working on, this online stuff, as a plot developing device. But the other thing is that it also is an occasion for world building, for actually developing very detailed landscapes, especially in areas that are not well mapped in Middle-earth, so that we can later get someone like Thomas to come in and do the actual cartography for it. And so I've been very excited about the current mapping project. And fortunately, my campaign hasn't progressed so far that I can't alter the basic geography to make it fit the new map. The third element that I find is very useful in the online format is that you can, and it really has more to do with the style of role-playing that one likes to do. It is action-oriented, but of course, in the doing of it, it's quite slow. Even if you have instant messaging and that sort of thing, combat will still take a much longer time. But of course, in retrospect, once it's all done, you can go back and read it. And I always edit my logs like a novel. And so combat goes very quickly, and it's very descriptive. With the kind of online game, you can also have a lot more internal monologues for characters. You can explore what they're feeling and thinking more than you can do in live stuff without slowing the pace down too much. And finally, it's a great way to do fan fiction. I've done some exploration into Middle-earth fan fiction, not writing it, but just seeing what's been written out there. And I've found that I've never had the patience to do writing. writing of that sort. But as soon as it's in a game format, it's really easy to do. Because it's far more, as Tolkien would say, self-created, because you, the author, are not actually determining the plot. And that makes it all the more realistic. If you have then the time to go back and edit it and develop and sort of polish the prose a bit more, it makes everyone look better at the end. You actually get a nice novel out of it. So one of the things I brought for Hawk to do with As He Wishes is the first two books of the campaign. We're working on a third one now. That was sort of just, all I really had to do was just this sort of progress report on what I've been working on. And I thought I'd leave it up to be open for questions about, I'd be interested to hear what sort of Middle-earth games you all do, what sort of format you use, either in terms of rule system or style or time period, because I am very much interested in what's actually going on at this time, other than Herbkind. We really don't have a lot of contact amongst one another, I think, in the Middle-earth gaming world, a lot of the perceptions that I think the industry, as well as the larger realm of Tolkien fandom have of Middle-earth role-playing is not based on accurate knowledge, and so I'd be interested to know what everyone's doing these days. Carl.
Well, actually, in terms of Middle-earth role-playing, they use the old Iron Mountain system. And it's a step up in complexity of Dungeons and Dragons. So, for my grandson and his friends, I'm using Dungeons and Dragons as a foundation to get them familiar with fantasy worlds, familiar with role-playing, and then, if they're interested, we'll take the next step to a Middle-earth role-playing environment. I don't have an ongoing adult game going right now. Rather, I have intermittent teenager games where I'm game master. And so, I'm viewing this as a two-step process. One, get them interested in role-playing, and secondly, if they're interested in doing something I feel very comfortable with.
What are some of the aspects of the Rolemaster system do you think that, in terms of its complexity level, that make it fun to use in Middle-earth?
Well, since I don't use pure Rolemaster, I use literally the old Merv system.
Yeah.
I think the diversity of it, I think the fact that crit tables are there and they're decisive in combat. Usually not hit points, they get you. It's the crit tables. I think it's a different style of combat. I think it's faster moving, more brutal, particularly if you limit magical healing, as I like to do. It gives a certain air of realism to it. And also, if you start to limit some of your magical exposure and encourage your players to play humans rather than say elves or hobbits or dwarves, which are let's say, I won't call them magical creatures, but in some respects you can view them as, if they appear today, as a magical creature in our world. It gets you closer to the Tolkien perspective on magic and how the role of humans and the focus on humans in this world. And whereas I think just sort of generally being a D&D approach, you lose some of that perspective.
I think that the point of character preference and perspective is an important one. I mean, we know that Tolkien himself used the hobbits as a kind of mundane perspective on an extraordinary world and an extraordinary history, and somehow that makes it easier to assimilate. And I too, in my own campaigns, I tend to focus on human situations, because it's easier for the players to identify that as a norm against the backdrop than it makes elves and dwarves more elvish and dwarvish somehow by having them not so commonplace.
And it makes magic more appreciated, because if it's real common, it's it values the importance of magic. I mean, to me, it was a feeling for the difference in the mentality. People feel very comfortable using a lot of magic when they're playing a high-level campaign, regardless of whether it's D&D or normally, whether they're using Rollmaster or the Wargames. However, if you limit that magic, then the appearance of the magic is something special. And I'll give you, for instance, how special it can be. I was running a game several years ago in which the players were supposed to retrieve something from a female elf. And all she did was use what in D&D would be called cantrips. And in a manner that set a certain logical pattern that so upset the party, they fled the scene of magic. And so that would not happen in D&D. I mean, you or in a standard, very magical Rollmaster or competition. So that's why I agree. It's important to limit that to get the appreciation of what magic is and what it's all about.
Yeah, another way you can do that is to, if you don't have an aversion to running for elven characters or dwarven characters, the key is always to craft a storyline that would only be meaningful for that character group. And often, because the high fantasy genre of role-playing games tends to work with a certain set of stereotypes that don't actually fit very well with elven and dwarven ethos, you know, from a Middle-earth perspective, it's kind of hard sometimes to fit them in, except in a way that makes them commonplace and less than interesting. One can use Middle-earth magic in ways that enhance, in a sense, the unique characteristics and motives of the different races that we've been getting at. Let's see where it goes. For example, in the I can give the Decipher example here. I did the article, which was never published, on the Palantir as a magic item, and I had the unenviable task of trying to find plot books for a late Third Age setting for using Palantir as magic items. Well, of course, that is very difficult. And in fact, the one Palantir that actually did seem to hold prospect of interesting storylines that could be woven around it, and that normal characters who did not have access to the inner sanctum of Sauron or Saruman could actually access at that time, other than Denethor, was the Palantir that faced towards the sea, right? The one that the elves had access to in Lindon. But it's a very different one would have a very different campaign based around that, because of course the Palantir only points west. And that's where one can find this was actually in the book The Road Goes Ever On, Tolkien's song book that he did with Donald Swan, where he talks about how the elves used that Palantir as kind of the object of a vision quest that would not be used to gain any particular magical power over the world, but rather would reconnect them to the West, which they could otherwise no longer have any contact with. And one of the features of the Palantiri, which Tolkien talks about in his essay on them, but which is never developed, as far as I know, in any of either the Decipher or in the Herb stuff, is that the Palantiri can see through time. It's not just that they can see in a defined space, but they can actually see into the past. One time I actually ran a campaign, this was one of the sidelines of a Kinstrike-based campaign, where you have the Palantiri and Gondor still accessible to the royal seers, and you could actually use them to see into the past, not just the distant past, but also the immediate past. You could solve crimes and things like that just by having a character who had access to. So you can base a whole campaign just around a single magic item, not something that could be manipulated at any time, of course, because you can't pick it up and leave. You have to go and use it at a point in time, but it's a great plot device. Now, I've never actually tried to do a Dworkin campaign, and so I don't know what how one would work in Dworkin motives, in Dworkin magic, in a way that wouldn't make it seem commonplace, but I'm sure it can be done. I'm sure some people have done. I know that Jason Hawkins of ICE did something on behalf of his Dworkin company, a campaign adventure that he ran at a convention a while back. So, yeah.
Did you work on that one?
Did I work on that? I did work on Dworkin Company, mainly on the backstory, but I didn't actually do any of the nuts and bolts of the tournament for it. That was all Jason Hawkins' work. And one wishes that he did complete it, because it was definitely very, very interesting. I did work on the Moria, on the Cypher's Moria book. Not the Moria module part that had to do with the mapping out of the Cosmic Doom, that was a different author, but I did the Dwarf's book, and I tried to create, with each of the seven tribes, some unique, not just a unique name and unique appearance, but also some unique power, magical, if you want to call it that, or some unique motive for that tribe, which would distinguish them in a game in which build a campaign around. That was very challenging. Of course, since Decipher didn't let you say much about the dwarves, and you had to have a book about them. But there's certainly a lot of room for development there, I think. Dwarves tend to get neglected in all fantasy games, unfortunately. And there certainly is more to be done there. One of the things that the maps, that I'm not going to say too much about the maps, because Thomas talked about those. One of the things that the maps do is they certainly open up new eras as settings for adventures, especially in Numenorean settings, such as we're developing here. And that, too, has been an obvious source for campaigning. Has never been exploited. Even ICE didn't really make use of it that much in these second age settings. So when I think about, back to Gary Gygax's famous comment in 1978, that you couldn't do a Middle-earth role-playing game because there was nothing to do in the world, because the ring was destroyed and that was that, I still think that 25 years after that statement was proven false, that we've still only scratched the surface, really.
Nobody will ever need more than 640K of RAM.
Exactly. Maybe you could say something about, without spilling the beans in your own talk, what are some of the things that you've done in your own Middle-earth games that you found to be useful?
I have done a lot like what Carl was talking about. Made things fairly mundane, not for the same reason. More from the perspective of the upper hand, which lends sort of a higher mien to the elves, the dwarves, the magic items. When they do show up, they seem more potent somehow, more other to the players, which then they
One of the ways that you can create complexity without creating a sense of it just being a big game that the GM is playing and the players are sort of on the sidelines is to do to use sort of what Hawk's been doing with these Numenor games. There's have defined beginnings and ends to kind of modular stories, but have them in a sequence, in a historical sequence, that even if the characters are different, if the players have played through those settings, you actually create storylines, you create facts that are not just dead facts as part of the background, but facts that the characters have played a part in fashioning, which become part of the background, and which become part of the complexity, but of course to the players it's not complex because they themselves were involved in it. And I think this is definitely, there is a temptation, and Tolkien himself talked about this in his letters sometimes, of it all being seeming like just one big game. And by that he didn't mean role-playing game, he meant a game in the author's mind of, you know, how complex a world can I make? The danger is always that pure indulgence, that self-indulgence in world creation gets torn away from the fabric of the story, of the lived game, and one always has to create a balance between those two. But one of the ways that you can, in a sense, develop them together is precisely by doing what we're doing here.
Didn't he say something about how he keeps stopping himself and getting into more and more and more detail in one of his letters? How he would just start doing a little really detail on one specific thing and have to catch himself to try to build on the rest of it.
Yeah, no, he had that problem of going from one issue to another and you know, sort of starting with something like, of course, when this became an acute problem was after The Lord of the Rings had been published and he had to revise the Silmarillion to his satisfaction to make it fit with that. And it's not that he couldn't, but that he had so many other interesting sidelines involved in that, such as the development of the languages, which, in a sense, we should be grateful for, because him thinking about, say, the etymology of the name Andrast led to the development of information about the place where we're now gaining in this campaign. He wouldn't have thought about that unless he was wondering what that word meant, or when he, more famously, when he was trying to develop Elven terms for personality and developed his theory of telepathy, which is very useful for gaming. So, although it may have been counterproductive to him, it actually worked out well for us, I think. And we know that there's still more of that stuff out there. It just gets published at a glacial pace. We'll hope that the people responsible for it continue to release it. But I think that in terms of what we can be doing as people who run the games and play games is not worry too much about, you know, building up an incredibly complex world, because on the one hand, it's already been done. We already have 25 years of, well, since 1980, 25 years of development, research and development on a single time period, which is still not fully fleshed out. But there's an incredibly rich reservoir of information just laying there for us to use or to ignore. And in the meantime, we need to be getting down to the real business of telling great stories that can develop that information. And I think that was both the great strength as well as the Achilles heel of the Merp series was precisely its focus on the world. Very few of the Merp modules had great plot ideas. A few of them did, but that was not the focus. And so, on the one hand, that made the modules very usable in many different contexts, not all of them Merp contexts. Many people just bought them for the maps, the detailed information. But because of the dearth of good storylines, good plots, and also just cool things that you can have characters do and think about, it ended up being fairly flat, I think, in the end, and lost a lot of people because of it. So I think that's what we should be doing now, and I think that's what we are doing. It doesn't matter whether someone has the license out there or not. I mean, the level of the depth that we're working at, I think, is beyond what anyone would publish anyway, so we don't need to worry about that. We just need to enjoy doing what we're doing. Other thoughts?
How do you feel? Do you feel like that the pen and paper gamers are like an ancient group?
I don't think so. I don't think so because I would include among pen and paper gamers online gaming of the sort that I was describing, as well as other modes. I mean, I would really expand it a bit more from pen and paper to any real life interaction, whether it's, you know, live gaming, going out, you know, in the woods, or being at a table, or exchanging emails. I think all of those have something in common, is that it is genuine human interaction that you can't get in a big multi-user environment, that you can't get in other forms of games. So I don't think it's, I don't really think we're a dying breed in that sense. I just think that we're actually finding new avenues to manifest that style of gaming.
And my efforts so far have been, I'm hoping next MerpCon we will have a kids table, because this neighborhood 14-year-old kid, he was 13 when we got there, is now role-playing. He's jammed his first session last week with a couple of his teenage friends, and he's been playing with my sons. So there's a whole other generation that at least I'm out there trying to get them, and they love it. I mean, he played computer games. He never knew before. He played online role-playing computer games, and even he admits, as much as he still loves the computer games, he won't quit them, there's something about them that he really loves, and he's totally excited about it. So I think there's just kind of, part of it, I think, is a lot of the bad press that's been developed about role-playing gaming. Which we covered in Other Minds magazine, right? And I think that had a lot of effect. I know here in Spokane, the certain religious organizations here encourage the families to not let their children be around role-playing gamers. I've had a personal experience with this, where our 7-year-old son, his best friend, is also, the mother is like the best friend of my wife, but they will not let their 7-year-old come to our house just because they know we role-play. Not because we role-play while they're there, or anything like that, just because we role-play, they will not let him come to the house. So, and it's because they have all this misinformation and disinformation out there. I think a major benefit would be trying to turn that around, get a lot more positive information out there over time. And it's going to take time. There was the Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons thing. That was a 9-year run of bad press, very actively trying to ban role-playing. And we're kind of in the shadow of that after effect, I believe. So the good thing is a lot of that subsided, so this next generation of teenagers and such seem a lot more open to it than the previous 10-year gap did.
I have an anecdote to tell about that. My first thing I was going to say in rebuttal to that is that I never run into any bad press like that, at least where I live, even in the conservative Midwest. I never get this people cold-shouldering me because I mentioned I do gaming. But I have to confess that on the way home from MerpCon 1, I got trapped on the airplane with this not sure what he was, religiously speaking, but definitely in that camp. When I told him that I had just come back from a gaming convention, he sort of happily nodded, and then I think about halfway through the conversation, he said, you know, you're going to hell for that.
Oh,
yeah. Oh. I said, me and everyone else who loves art.
Yeah.
No, this is maybe this is a bit off topic of what I started on, but I think that beyond the idiosyncrasies of the particular bad press on role-playing that you get in religious circles, I think it has far more to do with sort of the conservative evangelical attitude towards culture and art. I think that whether role-playing had good or bad press, it would be part of this cultural critique that they have been engaged in for several generations now. So I don't, in a sense, I don't think we need to worry too much about that, because that will always be there. But I do agree that there's definitely scope for turning the image around. But again, it's something that you can't really turn around unless you're actually doing it, and that's what we're doing here.
Right? Yeah, that's right. And so, for example, in the essay, I talked about that in a 10-year period, there were 111 major news articles about role-playing. Most of them were negative, indicating it to do with suicide or homicide or whatever, maybe social behavior, demonic, whatever. Only three were positive, and then maybe a dozen neutral. So there's this huge body out there of negativity, and somehow we need to generate more positive press, regardless of the religious groups or whatever, just getting the press out there in a positive way. So, and everybody who role plays would be a part of that, being an activist for role playing games.
Yeah, and I've always been curious as to why role playing has not been has not spread as much as I thought it might among Tolkien fans. Because I can't think when you go to Tolkien societies, if you do, there may be a role playing sort of group or segment, but it tends to be fairly small. I've always found it interesting that not more people who are interested in Tolkien don't get involved in Middle-earth gaming, because it seems to be the purest possible expression of self-creation. Tolkien's idea of the author and the audience interacting together to produce art, or at the least, entertainment. And that's always been what I see as the greatest benefit of role-playing, is that it's for free most of the time. And it's active. I don't feel like I'm wasting my life. Even if I didn't like the game, I would still think it would be far better use of my time than going to a movie that I didn't like and had to pay $10 to see. And I think, you know, in terms of a plus, you know, in our culture, the way it's going, the more active forms of entertainment and interaction that can be found, all the better. And I'm sure that there'll be many other folks in different parts of our society that would appreciate that. Like Norman Mailer. Norman Mailer actually wrote an article not about role-playing, but about reading. He said, in his view, there's only so much brain space and brain energy that you can devote to, and the more you devote to passive forms of absorbing images and absorbing television, the less you have to devote to creativity. Kind of active imagination that's involved in reading. And of course, again, that doesn't have to do with role-playing per se, but has everything to do with role-playing. So I do think maybe there are other strands in American culture that would appreciate greatly what role-playing is, if they knew about it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
A lot of people, they honestly, right on the house and start, and they frankly view that as like the nerd.
There's the geek problem too.
Yeah, stereotype. Love it.
Yeah. Well, this is
actually tried it at all.
Yeah, I think this is the greater Achilles heel is not the, you know, the conservative religious reaction, but it's simply the geekdom image.
Yeah.
Which to a certain extent is true, but a lot of it has to do with how people it has to do with the actual socialization of people into role playing networks. It has a lot to do, it historically, with sort of all-male gatherings. I've had the great fortune to have several years of gaming in which there's a gender-balanced group. A lot of that has to do with how the men and the women in the group come to know each other. But I think, with the new generation, parents who role-play, that's a good thing.
New generation.
There he is. Anything else?
So, do you think you should start an organization called Parents Who Role Play?
There you go.
That's an idea.
There you go.
That's an idea.
There is an activist group for role playing gaming advocacy.
Huh.
And in fact, Kaysen is the reason why he's here and we talk Sunday, because he's on that group as well. And each one's in charge of different areas of the world. And in trying to do that. And that's part of what Kaysen's going to talk about getting role playing gaming. Part of library literature and such.
Right.
So yes, that would be great, having coordinated those advocacy groups.
Yeah, I was telling last night that at the first work hunt we had been playing in the library.
Right.
And maybe that's an important sort of key is associate role playing with uplifting intellectual institutions like libraries and colleges. Who knows? But I guess our time is up, so let's take our next break and we'll move on. And I'll look forward to hearing everyone else talk about themselves. especially looking forward to all our other speakers. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chris, for coming.
Do we have questions and answers?
Real quick. We can do 5 minutes if you want to do Q&A real quick. He's got questions for you, Chris. You're going to put that back on? Sorry. Sorry.
Just. You have questions for issues.
Now that you've heard the question, what's the answer?
The answer is yes. What's the question?
Freedom of communication. Concern about why has the role playing taken off the more than it has with people. And I thought the same thing that's really interesting. A couple of things come to mind are lack of imagination. People don't always know how to express one's imagination, even though tons of people read fantasy novels and just love them. Yet they're not going to role play and express that in an imaginative, creative way. But part of that is also, what you've also got into is the socialization aspect. What it's associated with certain types of people, even though a wide variety of people role play. But it's not always easy to find role players. And there's so many different games out there. Systems to choose from. It can be overwhelming to find players that get along with you, which seems to be probably the biggest problem. Is if it was more widespread, it would be easier to integrate into. And,
sure.
So that those kind of seem problems to respond to.
Well, sure, those are problems, or at least those are challenges. I think I could answer to the first one of the problem of people who have a vivid imagination. They read a lot of fantasy literature, or at least literature in general, but they find it difficult to express that themselves. I find that in my recent experience in doing online dating, that's one way to overcome that. It's certainly been a way to overcome it for me, because when I run games, I find that sometimes unless I'm dealing with characters that I'm so comfortable with and have been playing for years, I can't improvise very well unless I have it all mapped out in writing for myself. But if you have the time to develop a character's personality and their moods and way of speaking in a written format in that kind of online exchange, after a while, you develop skills that you wouldn't normally have even in a live game. For example, like the NPC I was playing in the game today, I use one of my favorite characters in my online game, and I know exactly how he talks and what he would say, but I couldn't just be given a character like that without that background and just say, play a character like that. So I think that, I guess one of the other benefits of thinking through different mediums, both the tabletop, maybe the live, maybe the online as well, is that each medium can develop different aspects, different skills, player in the GM, because I'm firmly of the school that I don't believe there are geniuses in the world. I think that people do sometimes have gifts for things, but really you only are gifted in something you develop, and the medium is there to help you develop that skill, whether it's learning how to be active in a social environment, or learning how to describe yourself or assume the moods of a character. Most people aren't just given that. They have to develop it by practice. So, if it is difficult to find gamers in one medium, look for another.
Any other questions?
Okay.
We'll continue this conversation.
Yes. Thank you, Chris, for coming, everybody. Thank you.